So, in the early part of the 20th century, syndicalist organisations were surging forward in strength and significance. Syndicalism, for those that are unfamiliar with the term, can be broadly defined as revolutionary unionism. Some aspects of their ideas can appear to have a lot in common with Marxism. Syndicalists, like Marxists, see the class struggle as key to understanding the world and changing it. They're committed to the revolutionary overthrow of capitalist society. They argue for direct action of the working class and the use of general strikes to fight for better working conditions. Similar to Marxists, they have a bitter hostility to the betrayals of reformist political organisations, such as the Australian Labor Party, and they want genuine workers' control of society, not just state ownership. Likewise, we both reject capitalist militarism and stand for international solidarity between workers of the world. So we share a lot in common. Many syndicalists, even, such as the industrial workers of the world, even saw themselves as following in the footsteps of Karl Marx. But although there's a lot of common ground between Marxists and syndicalists, the debates over the theoretical differences between the two are crucial to understanding how workers can achieve their own emancipation. Unlike Marxists, syndicalists extrapolate from their hostility to reformism a hostility to all political action. They associate all politics with parliament and argue that politics, by definition, leads to a betrayal of the working class. Syndicalists reject the need for the working class to form a political party of its own. They argue that organising the working class into militant unions is the only organisation required. And it's these debates, the debates over these points, which I'm going to discuss in this talk and put an argument about why syndicalism ultimately is a dead end for the working class. So syndicalism was clearly the most significant revolutionary tendency worldwide up until 1917. There were large syndicalist organisations in Italy, Ireland, Britain, Spain, France, America, and even in Australia. And it was the industrial workers of the world, otherwise known as the IWW or the Wobblies, which were the largest syndicalist organisation in Australia. The industrial workers of the world were originally founded in 1905 in Chicago. They were frustrated with the conservative American Federation of Labor, which refused to organise migrants or casualise labour. Hundreds of radical unionists came together to form the IWW, which became legend for its militancy, its irreverence, and its dedication to the destruction of capitalism. In 1907, the Socialist Federation of Australia initiated IWW clubs to form an Australian section of the IWW. The ideas of the IWW were to find a broad reception in Australian society in the coming years. The IWW's orientation to industrial action on the job, as opposed to seeking concessions through the arbitration courts, resonated with a growing layer of workers. The preamble to the constitution of the IWW opened with the following lines. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things in life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until workers of the world organise as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. Now, from 1906 onwards, there was a growing audience for these revolutionary ideas in Australia. Economic conditions were improving after the long depression of the 1890s, but the workers' living standards were lagging significantly behind economic growth. The ALP had thoroughly purged itself of its initial radicalism and was busy proving itself a suitable party to run Australian capitalism. Union officials were cowardly. Rather than taking advantage of improved economic conditions and organising a wages push through strikes, they deferred to the power of the arbitration courts, which more often than not ruled in favour of bosses. So in the United States in 1908, debates emerged in the IWW between those who supported running for parliament as well as organising industrial unions and pure direct actionists who rejected any approach to politics as inevitably leading to the betrayal of the class. The majority of the IWW sided with the non-politicals who rejected that the working class had to take any attitude to politics. Like syndicalists across the world, the IWW viewed the struggle to overthrow capitalism as a purely economic question. For the Wobblies, organising workers into one big union which covered the entire class was sufficient. And once organised, the working class would simply take control over the workplace in a peaceful strike. It took a little longer for these debates to play out in the Australian section of the IWW. It was 1911 when the non-political IWW was founded in Adelaide. This hostility to politics comes as no surprise, considering how the ALP had betrayed workers' interests in Australia. In 1910, the ALP was elected to the federal government for the first time. This was for the first time that a Social Democratic Party had been elected to government in any country in the world. And for the first time, and remarkably, the Australian working class quickly became embittered with the ALP in office. Monty Miller was an example of the trajectory of many such militants. He was a founding member of the ALP, and he helped build the infant Labor parties. He described with, quote, shame and sorrow, how the ALP betrayed the best interests of workers and in many cases played the part of traitors to large bodies of workers in strike conflict with capitalism, end quote. Monty stormed out of the IWW during these debates over political action to join the newly formed non-political IWW. The establishment of the non-political IWW marks the beginning of the IWW proper in Australia. Its establishment coincided with the revitalisation of confidence within the working class. So with the growth in radicalism in the Australian labour movement, the IWW grew rapidly. In 1913, they had just 200 members. Just 4 years later, they had grown to 4,000 members. Their paper, Direct Action, regularly sold 15,000 copies. And this was in a period when publications were quite often passed along, so their readership would have been quite a bit higher. Now, as you would expect, a group with an uncompromising hatred of capitalism and the Labor Party did not win many favours amongst the ruling class. As the IWW drew thousands to their regular meetings on street corners and parks like the Sydney Domain, the authorities tried their best to stop the IWW from organising. Police regularly arrested and incarcerated Wobblies for speaking to crowds on street corners. The tactics that the IWW employed to win free speech fights, particularly in the Sydney Domain, Newcastle and Port Pirie, gives a taste of their iconoclastic style. In mid-1914, Charlie Reeve was arrested for refusing to move on while addressing an IWW meeting in Port Pirie. In response to this, the IWW Port Pirie local pledged to fill every jail in South Australia until the IWW was given free speech. According to one of the leaders of the IWW, Tom Barker, he said, quote, "When they, the Wobblies, got into jail, these fellows, being well organised, turned it upside down. They made it such a misery for the staff of the jails and for the authorities that they were only glad to get rid of them." Now, this seemed to alarm the local authorities because the arrival of only 17 IWW members from Adelaide and two from Broken Hill and two from Adelaide was sufficient enough to cause them to lift the ban on the IWW speaking in Port Pirie. And there are other examples of, this quite sort of brash style of the IWW. In New South Wales, when IWW members were put into jail, they would turn the jail upside down by carrying out the warden's orders in completely the reverse order. So when they were told to line up in the jail's courtyard, told to turn left, they turned right, and so forth and so on. The American IWW actually unionised the inmates and organised strikes within the prisons. So. Now, meanwhile, in Sydney, the New South Wales Labor government of W.A. Holman attempted to prevent the spread of the IWW by jailing them for selling literature, for taking up collections, and for singing to attract a crowd. Defying these ordinances meant arrest, fines, and jail. On principle, the IWW preferred to serve jail time rather than pay these fines. Tom Barker and a fellow Wobbly, Tom Glynn, went to pay a visit to the minister responsible for this censorship, Fred Flowers. When they were refused admittance, they scaled a ladder and climbed into Flowers' office through the window, where they quite rudely interrupted Flowers and two other ministers' enjoyment of whiskey and cigars and so forth. And then they proceeded to threaten them that 10,000 unemployed would storm their offices unless the restrictions on their speaking was lifted. A few days later, at the Political Labor League's conference, this was the New South Wales section of the Labor Party at the time, Wobblies demanded the right to free speech before barricading the doors and cutting the lights. In the ensuing chaos, one of the Labor League's delegates had to throw a chair out the window to get the police to come and rescue them. So it's through these battles that the IWW won the right to sell their paper and hold their meetings in public. And it was through these victories the IWW seemed to be unstoppable. Direct Action claimed that the IWW couldn't be stopped by state repression. quote, it only augments our growth, makes it command public attention, end quote. However, the IWW underestimated the power of the state. Direct action statements that the government couldn't legislate it out of existence did prove tragically incorrect, and we'll come back to that a bit later. Now, it was with the outbreak of World War I that the IWW gained the peak of its notoriety and influence. In a war that was eventually to claim 16.5 million people and maim 21.2 millions more, the Labour Party scrambled to pledge Australian workers to the trenches. The IWW, to their credit, answered the sabre-rattling of the global ruling class with call to arms against capitalism. On August 10, 1914, the front cover of Direct Action read, "War, what for? For the workers and their dependents, death, starvation, poverty and untold misery. For the capitalist class, gold, stained with the blood of millions, riotous luxury, banquets of jubilation over the graves of their dupes and slaves. War is hell. Send the capitalists to hell and wars are impossible." The IWW devoted a lot of effort into anti-war propaganda. On their street meetings, they fiercely denounced the Labor governments for their support of the war. And often they had to defend their meetings from being assaulted by soldiers, police, or pro-nationalist supporters of the war. The IWW also identified that it needed to work along other forces on whatever issue it could to hamper the war effort. So while never giving up their hostility to the war in general, the IWW became a significant part of the campaign around the more minimal demand against conscription. The campaign against conscription successfully hampered the then Labor Prime Minister Billy Hughes' two attempts to introduce conscription in Australia. Hence, Australia was one of the few countries out of the Allies in World War I which did not introduce conscription. And also, the IWW's work in the anti-conscription campaign helped build a stronger anti-war sentiment within the Labor movement and within Australian society more broadly. It was during the anti-conscription campaign that the then Labor Prime Minister, Billy Hughes, stepped up repression against the IWW. Hughes made the famous promise to strike with the ferocity of a Bengal tiger, end quote, to destroy the IWW. Police began the regular practice of raiding known wobbly homes. It became common for IWW members to have their houses broken into, to have all their documents and literature confiscated by the police. And in late September and early in October of 1916, the police arrested 12 members of the IWW on the charge of treason felony. Of the 12, 11 were prominent figures within the IWW. Charlie Reeve, Tom Glynn, Peter Larkin, Jack Hamilton, Donald Grant and J.B. King were all among them. The IWW 12, as they became known, refused bail and held in isolation from one another. They had no right to communicate or receive visitors. The charges laid against them alleged that they did intend to, quote, levy war against the king within the state of New South Wales by means of burning down Sydney businesses, end quote. And this trial was a frame-up from start to end. The key informant, Henry Scully, was promised a £2,000 reward for ensuring that the IWW ended up being convicted. To make sure that he didn't squeal after the trial, Scully was first deported, and then later when he returned to Australia, was kicked to death by police officers to prevent him from talking. Police planted evidence or asked witnesses to plant evidence in the 12's pockets. And after the trial, the government gave payouts ranging from £12 to £50 to every officer that was involved in the arrest of the IWW 12. Justice Pring sentenced 7 of the 12 to 15 years of hard labour, 4 received 10 years, and 1 5 years, all with hard labour. Justice Pring, on handing down his sentence, said, quote, you are members of an association which I do not hesitate to state, after the revelations in this case, is an association of criminals of the very worst type, and a hotbed of crime. I hope now that very strong and drastic steps will be taken to uproot that association. Soon after, Prime Minister Hughes satisfied Pring's hopes by passing the Unlawful Associations Act. This act meant that any IWW member who inhibited the war effort would receive a mandatory sentence of 6 months' jail. Unsatisfied with the effect of this act, Hughes amended the Unlawful Associations Act in July 1917 to increase its powers. Under the new Act, anyone suspected of being a member of an organisation that was proscribed by the Governor-General, such as the IWW, would face 6 months imprisonment unless they could prove that they weren't a member of that association. So it was guilty until proven innocent. A member of a proscribed association had to be automatically removed from any Commonwealth job. Publications of such an organisation could not be handled by post, and all property of the association would be confiscated. The IWW learnt the hard way that the capitalist state can bring a whole range of repressive measures to bear against them. A revolutionary organisation of a few thousand members cannot stand up to consistent arrest, jailing and raids of the state. Now, in a few years, the IWW was no more. The IWW locals either dissolved themselves to avoid imprisonment or smashed themselves by publicly defying the law with foolish bravado. Now, while the impact of the Unlawful Associations Act shows that the state can and will intervene violently to defend Australian capital, this was not the only reason why the IWW was defeated. It's a widespread idea that the IWW was beaten not because they made any political mistakes, but because the state was just too strong. However, other revolutionary organisations, such as the Bolsheviks in Russia, or even revolutionaries operating in Egypt today, face far worse repression and still survive. In the face of the Unlawful Associations Act, it was the IWW's syndicalist politics which failed to stand the test. So to uncritically idolise the IWW is immensely foolish, and Marxists today have to learn from the failures of the IWW and why syndicalist politics cannot lead to socialism. The ideas of syndicalism gained such a mass audience because their ideas resonated with the experience of the working classes of many countries in the beginning of the 20th century. Syndicalism was originally a positive reaction to the portrayals of reformism. It was a step forward from the political tradition of social democracy, which in most parts of the world, preached about socialism as being an inevitable process. And this dovetailed neatly with their practice as parliamentary cretins, because if the tide of history would inevitably bring socialism, well, what need was there really to take any principled stance in support of the working class on a day-to-day aspect? However, while syndicalism was a positive development in reaction to social democracy, it was in many ways the mirror image of reformism. They shared the same framework of seeing that there was a dichotomy between politics on the one hand and an economic sphere on the other. Both saw politics as being the realm of politicians in Canberra. However, their opinions of such people differed wildly. So whereas the Labor Party celebrated and lauded these people, the IWW would have preferred to see them hanging from the lampposts. And on the other side, both of them saw that the political sphere would never in any way interact with the economic sphere. So both saw unions as being the realm and worker struggles as being the realm of economics and Parliament being the realm of politics. Now, this was a problem because syndicalists, like the IWW, would accept anyone, regardless of their political ideas, as long as they supported the immediate demands of the class struggle. So the American IWW said, "A working man may be an anarchist or a socialist, a Catholic or a Protestant, a Republican or a Democrat, but subscribing to the preamble of the IWW, he is eligible for membership, and we are not responsible for his individual views and activities. So long as the individual performs his duties as a loyal member of the union, his personal affairs remain inviolate." So you have to wonder, how can a worker both, on the one hand, openly support a bourgeois party like the Democrats or the Republicans, and at the same time be for the abolition of the wages system? The truth is that the political and economic struggle constantly intertwine. In 1906, the Polish revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg described this in her essay, The Mass Strike. She says, Every new onset and every fresh victory of the political struggle is transformed into a powerful impetus for the economic struggle, extending at the same time its external possibilities and intensifying the inner urge of the workers to better their position and their desire to struggle. After every foaming wave of political action, a fructifying deposit remains behind from which a thousand stalks of economic struggle shoot forth. And conversely, the workers' condition of ceaseless economic struggle with the capitalists keeps their fighting energy alive in every political interval. Only Marxism offers a perspective which overcomes the false dichotomy between politics and economics. For Marxists, politics is not centred around parliament, but infuses every aspect of social life. Whenever the masses fight to defend or improve their rights, whether the issue be solidarity with Palestine, stopping the bosses ravaging the earth, or demanding the right to access to abortion, they are engaging in politics. But in turn, these political questions are inextricably linked up with the broader class relations in society, that is, with economic questions. Furthermore, in order to win basic political rights, workers have commonly been forced to exercise their economic power through strike action. Similarly, when workers fight around economic issues like wages and conditions, a whole series of political questions will be thrown up during the struggle. Their attitude to the state, the ALP, and the role of the trade union officials, the position of ethnic minorities, women, and so on, can be crucial for the success of their economic demands. In society, the spheres of economics and politics are not separated in everyday existence. So, as such, there is no purely economic or purely political struggles. Any struggle will contain elements of each. And the recent strike waves in Egypt in 2009 is a contemporary example of this. A wave of strikes for greater wages by textile workers and tax collectors resulted in impressive gains. Tax collectors won pay increases of up to 375% in one instance. The victory in achieving these economic demands bolstered the confidence of striking workers to raise the political demand of overthrowing Hosni Mubarak's government and free elections. In contrast to this, the IWW thought that the only form of organisation that was required was economic organisation. As an edition of their paper, Direct Action, stated, by organising industrially into one big union of all workers, regardless of sex, creed or colour, we will be able to attain that solidarity which alone can abolish wage slavery and usher in the new society. Now, the first thing that people might say after that quote is say, well, hang on a second, that clearly did talk about questions of discrimination, sex, creed and colour, which are clearly political questions. So to talk about that, I'm going to quickly touch on their attitude towards oppression. So the IWW did have a really poor attitude towards sexism, which meant that they were largely cut off from women workers. Joy DeMoussi, who's a Melbourne-based or an Australian academic, her research says that at one point, the IWW, out of 1,144 members, only had 25 women members. They did, however, take many good positions in regards to racism in Australian society, but their framework of explaining racism was an economic question. But this meant that they had no real theory of understanding or explaining oppression. Mostly they blamed racism on the narrowness of the craft unions, saying that, you know, that they wanted to exclude migrant labour because they were too busy focusing on maintaining their craft as a more prestigious section of the economy. They rightly pointed out that racism allows the bosses to hyper-exploit a section of the workforce, dragging down the conditions of the working class as a whole. But racism does not just occur within the confines of the workplace. It permeates all of the experiences of the oppressed. So while they opposed things like the White Australia policy, they didn't have much of a theoretical explanation for why it existed or how to combat it. Further to this, because the IWW considered that there to be no race problem, but just a part of the exploitation of the working class, they did not consistently reject racism. The IWW did not reject the mainstream idea of Aboriginal people being as a dying race. Because Indigenous Australians were either enslaved or were not part of the formal economy, the IWW paid next to no attention to the genocide of Aboriginal people. Because of their abstention from politics, they didn't combat the general political arguments of society, and so capitulated to some racist notions. Particularly in the anti-conscription campaign, while they published critiques of the conservative sections of the campaign, which would use the bogey of coloured labourers, which might replace white labourers, they used this as a central issue of the campaign, the IWW also published articles which clearly capitulated to this notion. So Direct Action wrote in one of their editions, in previous wars, we find that the ruling classes repeatedly broke all promises made to lower classes. The South African heroes found that they had fought to get the mines for the plutocrats and the jobs for the Chinese. It's quite likely that a similar event might occur here. So clearly there were big problems with the IWW's approach and that because they saw things as just the focus of economic questions, they didn't really take up with any consistency questions of oppression, race, sexism, and so forth. So the IWW aspired to organise the working class into one big union. Once all workers were organised under the banner of a single union, the overthrow of the capitalist order was as straightforward as calling a general strike. However, the IWW didn't actually do much in the way of building such a union. A lot of the time it was devoted to lobbying existing union officials to reorganise the unions along the lines of industry. The IWW's criticism of the narrowness of craft unions was well founded. When organising workers in unions alongside their occupation, it can erect artificial barriers between workers in the same industry, just because they have a different skill set. In industrial unions, workers can have more power, and there's a potential for greater solidarity. And this sentiment wasn't only confined to revolutionaries around this time. The recognition that unions would be better off organised along the lines of industry was quite widespread in Australia at the time. Even many union officials also campaigned for this idea. But even though organising unions along industrial lines is an improvement of the unions, organising industrial unions did not guarantee more radical unions. There was another organisation around at the same time as the IWW, which wanted to organise all workers under a single union. And this was the Australian Workers' Union. The AWU was the largest union in Australia at the time and remains one of the largest unions today. The AWU is also one of the bulwarks of the hard right in the Labor Party. Today, the AWU tries to poach membership from left-wing unions like the CFMEU and the AMWU. They take reactionary political positions. For instance, a recent opinion piece written by Paul Howes, the National Secretary of the AWU, was titled Dubai Killing Strikes a Blow for Decency, where he describes his support for Israel's recent assassination of a Palestinian political figure in Dubai. And in the early 20th century, the AWU was well known for its racist exclusion of migrant workers and its firm opposition to strikes. When New South Wales and Queensland shearers went on strike in 1916, the AWU denied them funds to wage the strike. So clearly the IWW was wrong. Organising unions along the lines of industry does not mean that they'll necessarily be radical organisations. Now, this is because unions are organisations for the defence of workers' interests under capitalism. They aren't organisations of revolution. Any successful workers' struggle requires the broadest possible unity. Unions attempt to unite all workers, regardless of their political ideas. They combine workers, both revolutionary and reformist, under the same organisation. So for a union to take revolutionary action, first revolutionary ideas would have to have won hegemony in the working class. Furthermore, the larger and more established the union becomes, it builds up an apparatus around it of full-time officials and representatives. The bureaucracy of a union becomes to have interests distinct and separate to the interests of the workers who they represent. Officials of the union do not share the same conditions as their members. They receive substantially higher wages and lead substantially different lives. If a strike is defeated or if the courts refuse to grant better pay, the officials' income and working conditions are not affected. Most importantly, they have no interest in abolishing capitalism. Their position in society, the role as negotiators between capital and labour, is only necessary under capitalism. Given the union officials have a material interest, this gives the union officials a material interest in preserving capitalism in the last resort. So unions have a contradictory role in capitalism. They are both the basic organisations of defence for the working class, but also play a role in managing the discontent of workers to prevent it from threatening capitalist society. In the United States, the IWW had an even worse strategy than the IWW in Australia, and that was of dual unionism. The American IWW took the attitude that the existing union officials were hopelessly corrupt. They embarked on a project to build the one big union by organising those who American Federation of Labour refused to organise. And they also argued that existing members of the union of unions which were aligned to the AFL should leave and join the IWW. This project of dual unionism was never attempted by the Australian section because the existing unions were much stronger in Australia than they were in the United States, and the IWW would not have had much luck by in trying to draw workers away from them. And we have to say it was actually a good thing that the IWW wasn't able to attempt the childish crap of dual unionism. The project of building so-called revolutionary unions in competition to conservative unions is very destructive to the workers' movement. No matter how radical the officials of a union are, they can't escape the tendencies outlined earlier because of the role that unions play under capitalism. Furthermore, by organising in separate unions, revolutionaries are abstaining from trying to combat the right wing of the organised working class. By dragging the most militant sections of the working class into separate union structures, the IWW would have taken the working class backwards. Because rather than organising within the existing unions to strengthen the rank and file and fight for the most left-wing leadership possible, the IWW would have rather abstained altogether. So take, for example, the Builders Labourers Federation, one of the most radical unions in Australian history. Now, for decades, its leaders were not only right-wing, but were corrupt and would use brute violence to entrench their control of the union. And eventually, the left, led by members of the Communist Party, won the leadership of that union, not by setting up a revolutionary union, but by building a network of militants within to smash the influence of the right. And a final point about the IWW's industrial strategy is about their doctrine of sabotage. The IWW agitated for workers to sabotage plant and machinery to win demands. Now, a lot of wobblies have said that, well, sabotage only meant the withdrawal of workers' efficiency, go-slows, or intentionally making mistakes on the job. But a lot of examples of their literature actually argue to destroy machinery. And this is a real problem because individual sabotage is counterposed to the mass involvement of workers. It creates an impression that heroic individuals can substitute themselves for genuine solidarity within the working class. Also, sabotage would only real appeal to a radical minority within the working class. In less volatile workplaces, it cut off the IWW from most of their other workers. It also made it much easier for the Labor Party and the media to whip up hysteria about the IWW when they alleged that they were committing arson throughout Sydney. So the IWW didn't grasp the contradictory nature of unions, which was one of their central weaknesses. Marxism explains these questions. Marxists argue for industrial action that involves the greatest number of workers possible, because it's through the experience of struggle, like going on strike, having to grapple with the politics and the strategies and tactics that are needed to win, the working class can be won to the politics of socialism. Whereas individualistic actions like sabotage can only serve to alienate workers from themselves. So rather than attempting to build politically pure unions, we fight the influence of the right within unions. We push towards building up the strength of the workers in the unions to discipline the bureaucracy. And ultimately, Marxists understand that unions are not vehicles for revolutionary change in society. For that, the working class has to be able to counter the capitalist class control of state power. Now, because of the IWW's orientation to economic organisation alone, they had a naive attitude to the power of the capitalist state. They rationalised that the power of the state rose from the economic power of the capitalist class. Once workers had seized control of the economy from the capitalists, the state would cease to be a question. So they wrote in Direct Action, "Far mightier than the might of the master class, with all their machinery of oppression, is the power of the folded arms. In this battle, no life need be lost, no blood need be spilt. The power of one big union of the working class can stop all capitalist violence and bring the captains of industry to their knees." Now, surely when the Australian class gladly takes part in the murder of over a million Iraqis, it would quite easily use much greater force when it was their power that was threatened at home. So this naivety was evident after the IWW was declared illegal. The IWW's opposition to the state proved quite brittle. The more radical locals of the IWW put on foolhardy displays of defiance, like the Broken Hill local, which stapled the names of their members to the door of the meeting hall, at a time when membership carried an automatic 6-month prison sentence. The Sydney local also carried out ridiculous acts of bravado, like sending their members one after the other to proclaim their membership in the Sydney Domain, only to be dragged off to prison straight after. And eventually, the consistent arrests scared the Sydney local into folding, Other locals, like the one in Melbourne, didn't even attempt to defy the laws at all. They simply dissolved themselves and never met as the IWW again, because they had really no strategy of challenging it, except for putting on these sort of displays of defiance. And the IWW failed to survive once declared illegal. Practically all serious revolutionary groups in history have undergone periods of proscription. The IWW's failure to survive, which was survive repression, which was lenient in comparison to the repression faced by revolutionaries in many situations, reflected their theoretical formulation that underplayed the role of the state in crushing dissent. So even though the IWW was vitriolic towards the state and politics, this hostility did not translate into having a theory that showed how to defeat it. Because of the syndicalist way of viewing everything in the framework of economic relations, without considering the necessary political questions, they did not come to terms with the need for the working class to actually fight to take state power. And proscription had dealt a huge blow to the IWW, but international events soon after were the final nail in the coffin for the IWW. In November 1917, the working class in Russia settled in practice the debate between syndicalism and Marxism. The Russian Revolution and revolutions since proved the need for the working class to take state power. The Bolsheviks had maintained throughout the revolution that the key task for the working class to attain victory was for the working class to expropriate power from the capitalist class. Events during the course of the revolution proved them correct. Very early on, the working class had taken control of their individual workplaces. Workers' councils, Soviets in Russian, flourished throughout workplaces in the industrial centres of Russia, such as Petrograd and Moscow, placing control of the shop floor in the hands of labourers themselves. However, the bosses quite quickly used a whole range of measures to try and disrupt workers' control of the workplace, such as destroying machinery, sabotage, stopping the flow of supplies and so forth. So to actually take control of the economy required much more than just taking control of individual workplaces. It actually meant that you need a centralised organisation to be able to impose workers' will to suppress the interests of the capitalist class. And this was something that IWW never really formulated about. Something that, you know, as Marxists we go on a lot about the need for workers to have a state, to have state power, to be able to cement their control over society. Finally, there was always the threat of military coup. In Russia, the ruling class was determined to defeat the revolution by any means necessary. John Reed's account of the October Revolution, 10 Days That Shook the World, describes how ruling class figures openly supported the German army invading rather than allowing Soviets to take power. And in August of 1917, General Kornilov launched a coup not only to destroy the Soviets, but parliamentary democracy as well. All of these things show that the question of the seizure of power can't be ignored. Power exists in society. If the working class doesn't take power with its democratic institutions, it will naturally be wielded by the capitalist class. And the IWW had no program for how the working class would take power. The working class in Russia didn't come to the realization that it needed to take state power automatically. At the 1872 conference of the First International, Karl Marx said, as part of his address, "The working class cannot act as a class except by constituting itself into a political party, separate and distinct from and opposed to all old parties formed by the propertied classes." In Russia, this was precisely the case. After February 1917, it wasn't just a smooth progression as more and more workers became convinced of the need to take state power. The Bolsheviks had to win political hegemony within the working class. They had to wage arguments, not just to convince workers of their immediate tactics, but also of their political program and theory. To do this, those who were already convinced of revolution and socialism had to be organised in a party. In any upheaval, there will be political forces which are hostile to the working class taking power. The syndicalist attitude of ignoring or being agnostic to political questions did not win workers away from reactionary conclusions. In actual fact, it leaves the field of battle open to forces who are thoroughly anti-revolutionary. This is why revolutionaries have to be organised in a political party, to challenge the influence of anti-revolutionary politics within the working class. For all these reasons, the syndicalist movement worldwide was subsumed by revolutionary Marxism. The success of the Russian Revolution in achieving workers' power more than anything else, marked the end of syndicalism as a major current in the workers' movement. With the exception of the anarcho-syndicalists in Spain, which maintained a mass following up until 1936, syndicalism went into terminal decline after 1917. The IWW in Australia was never to regain its strength. By 1933, a military intelligence report stated that there were only 4 people who were official members of the IWW. The key reason for the decline was that the IWW could not adjust to the new political situation. So in the wake of the Russian Revolution, several leading figures in the IWW drifted to the right. Tom Barker joined the British Labour Party. Donald Grant eventually became the image of the Labour leaders the IWW despised. He joined the ALP, eventually being elected to the Federal Senate, and in 1949 he not only supported the jailing of coal miners' officials, but he also encouraged strike breaking. Some IWW leaders, like J.B. King, were convinced of Marxism after 1917 and helped form the Communist Party of Australia in 1921. And thereafter, the vanguard of the working class, workers with the clearest line of march, those who had a hatred of capitalism and wanted to fight to get rid of it, were organised in the communist parties. After the formation of the Communist Party, only the most dogmatic of the IWW persisted, so the handful of self-identifying wobblies never really had much serious impact in Australian politics again. So, by means of conclusion, I think the history of the IWW shows us a couple of things. It shows that workers en masse can be convinced of revolutionary conclusions. The IWW was not the only site of syndicalist politics. Actually, syndicalism was quite widespread within the working class, and there was broad popularity for the ideas of, you know, overthrowing capitalism. It also shows us that serious revolutionary groups can be built. The IWW, its membership of 4,000, each member had to commit to doing not only one or two meetings a week, but like, you know, 10 meetings every week pretty much, like constant organising and political activity. But it also shows us that unless you build these groups on the basis of serious ideas, a serious political theory, then it's built on sand. There's no real substitute for the correct ideas. I think that's the strength of Marxism, that not only it tries to explain the surface manifestations of capitalism, the relations between bosses and workers within the workplace, but has a broader depth of theory to explain all manners of capitalist society, whether it's ideas, consciousness, the theory of taking power, revolution, how workers can win. These things, I think Marxism has a strength over syndicalism. So that's where I'll finish.